Thank you very much. I was asked by Barry just to quickly touch on about abatements area. That's carbon credits. I don't know if anyone's heard about this and offsets. It's not really my quite background. I'm in the auditing side of the company. But so basically, these are a way of encouraging projects, you know, to save on emissions. And basically, we want to know that they're measurable, verifiable, and that you get what you're paying for. Basically, there's really, I'm talking about two things here, the international and the national schemes. The first two, which people may not have heard of, the CDM, the Clean Development Mechanism, and the Joint Implementation. These are the Kyoto Protocol-related emission reduction units. So these basically, in the context for Australia with the upcoming CPRS, with the reductions that, you know, once it kicks in post-2010, initially, companies can use 5% of their purchases from these pool of reduction units, and the rest have to be related to the permit system. And this will decrease in time so that we actually force, because a lot of these are outside of Australia, so this, you know, creates the change in Australia. Then there's the gold standard, which is basically what it is, the gold, the top of the league type thing, and it's a basically extension of the CDM. And that it's got other tangibles to it in terms of just its environmental sustainability behind it. And then there's the voluntary side of things. A lot of people ask the question, well, what's the difference between, you know, why the different dollar amounts to carbon credits, etc.? And really it's coming, if you go to the point of saying, well, when you go and buy oil for your car, you know, you go and buy 4 litres, you know, there's different ranges of quality, and it's basically related to that. Four litres is 4 litres of oil, but you do have different qualities and you pay for it. And it's the same with a carbon credit. Well, it's one tonne of credit, but it does have a range of qualities behind it. And in Australia, there's basically the greenhouse friendly, there's the NGAC system, and there'll be others coming for sure. And these are all voluntary, but these are things like when you want to offset your flights, etc., that you can go and purchase. This is basically what it is, it's the voluntary market. And you, well, these aren't going to be part of the CPRS scheme. So, you know, a number of categories that fall into all this, and you probably have a lot of people have heard, of course, the forestry and methane recovery. So that's, you know, landfill gas, etc., and other bits and pieces that we can look at capturing carbon credits. And really, the criteria and important things are, you know, we want proof of title. You know, it's not double counted, so, you know, someone doesn't sell it twice over, that it's actually additional, that it's actually measurable, it's the real thing, you know, and it's quantifiable. You know, we don't want to pay for something that's not actually there. And that's a little bit different, because when you go to just offsets, if you go by, you know, give some money to, you know, well, it's all intent is well and good. If you go to, you know, purchase an offset to a, you know, provider and like a non-government organisation, you say, we'll go and plant some trees for you, that's well and good, but it's not the same thing, okay? It's not quantifiable. They haven't gone through the same verification process. So it's a bit like a share. You're actually buying something here, okay, a real tangible thing. The others are good initiatives, but they're not necessarily related to, I mean, their intention is well and good, but you can't demonstrate further than that. So with the auditing side, you'll see more and more of this, of course, companies having to report. That's what I'm basically involved in. So really with the ENGAS scheme and how it works, it's broken down into, we're using the greenhouse gas protocol, and basically it's divided the sources into three components. So fuel you burn directly, or emissions related to refrigerants and other fuel combustion, like in your home, you know, if you burn natural gas, they're defined as scope one. Purchase electricity, or if you purchase process heat, is defined as scope two, and everything else is defined as scope three. So basically it's a mechanism just to, so we don't get double accounting in when we do this sort of thing. So quickly with Australia, may not know, so this is 2006 numbers. We're looking at 576 million tonnes, and most of that's related to our electricity generation. I suppose there's a, you know, with cost of climate change, it can be an interesting game. I think, you know, the comic says sometimes can be a bit, that's what it can be a bit like, just pick a number and it's always that. But I think really I could almost end on the whole discussion here on the slide with this. Well, I could end this conversation really on this slide. You know, at present, if business as usual, of course we pay $0 for our emissions. Based on 2006, 576 million tonnes. Professor Garner said initially we'll be around $20 a tonne. So what does that actually mean? If we actually had to cost the whole damn lot, it'd be about $11.5 billion. What's that, about 1% or so GDP of a $1 trillion economy? It's peanuts, literally. And we've seen with the market meltdown, probably what, $400, $500 billion has been obliterated amongst everything else. I mean, what's that? They would have paid for 45, 50 years worth of these emissions. And we have all these companies complaining the world's ended. You know, I don't know about you, but it's a bit of a, you know, Mickey Mouse charade they make on about that it's, you know, it's going to kill us to do this. Obviously, some things are going to be more. I mean, we shall talk about fuel. It's related to the, you know, greenhouse gas emissions. So some things are going to be slightly more. Some things won't have the same. Obviously, like when we do this economic analysis, or I don't because I'm not an economist, but you know, it's very difficult in the area of environmental regulation because you know basically we're hampered by two things. And first is that you know Google says it's very difficult to evaluate costs that. Than the benefits of the environmental programs and how do you do things that are not covered? So how do you put a price on cleaner air and water and, you know, human health is a classic one, you know. How do you actually put a price on, a person suffering with cancer or something like that from the outcomes? You know, exactly how far do you go? What do you cover? Most times they have to limit because the study can't cover everything. So, you know, you have to stop somewhere. You know, interesting thing, of course, with Hurricane Katrina, they've estimated about up to 1 million people now have post-traumatic stress disorder. I mean, how do you price that in? You know, we know how to, you know, rebuild a house. Yes, there's a definable amount to that, but, you know, the stress involved for someone in such a horrific cataclysmic sort of event. I mean, this was just Hurricane Ike and a picture there. And it sort of exemplifies, I mean, right, there's one house left, fine, we can rebuild, you know, if they ever would again, but, you know, we can define that cost very easily, but, you know, imagine you're that person that comes back to this scene, I mean, how do you put a dollar amount to that sort of stress? And really, what has history told us? Really, there's the closest thing in terms of pollution, we've got the Clean Air Act, I mean, we've got similar things now here with the EPA. And really, you know, every time they try to push in, well, when they initially tried to push this in, you know, the world's going to end, you know, it's cost too much, can't do it, it's too hard, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, three separate studies have shown that, in the end, the aggregate benefits clearly outweigh the aggregate costs. And alone the EPA have just said that, you know, up to $70 billion just for 5 years in 1994 dollars. So it's quite clear the benefits. I mean, we can see that with tobacco. You know, they fought it for a long time, no one was cancer, and we know what the costs are involved with this. So how do we tackle this issue? I've taken this really from Professor Sokolov in the Princeton University. Well, Gavin mentioned that we're trying to, obviously Australia's going to have a target of reducing by 60%. I don't know how, or anywhere in the world, how we're going to really achieve that. Hopefully we can, but basically, the idea is now, at best, can we at least try and stabilise our growth in emissions? And so can we do this? You know, well, we do have all the science and know-how now available to do this. It's not rocket science. We do have what's our answer. And, of course, it's not going to be one answer. It's going to be multiple solutions to this problem to do this. And some of the things, of course, are quite simple things. Improve fuel efficiency, you know, building more efficient buildings. It's very easy stuff. It's not, of course, putting renewables, a whole lot of things, quite simple things. Each thing will add. So how does it really work? Well, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. You can't do the whole thing in one big gulp. You get indigestion. So that's how you do it. Do a little bit, and hopefully we can do it. And it all adds up in time. What you start now propagates further down, and that's the key thing. That's why the later we wait, the worse it's going to be, the harder and steeper we have to try and change. So obviously we have an issue, of course, legacy of infrastructure, things we build. You know, dams are there for maybe 100 years. We're just building a Northern Expressway here. It's, you know, based on the paradigm, of course, that oil is going to be cheap. You know, we're doing these things now. So the quickest and easiest thing is energy efficiency. We see it time and time again. I undo audits. You know, I just did a jewellery shop. Didn't even really have to try to get emissions down 10% saving. It took a very easy, simple solution of changing the light globes, and that was $1,600 to the bottom line straight away. Actually, implementation cost was actually nothing really for them. There's so many things just so people just waste that it's so easy to change. And so while the price of electricity may go up 30, 40%, we can save very easily. And it's been shown here by the National Framework for Energy Efficiency that, you know, you can get 30% reduction with 4-year paybacks and up to 70% in 8-year paybacks. So it's not hard to do. And even Amory Lovins, he's pretty much the granddaddy of energy efficiency based in the US. He's pretty much the guru on that. And he time and time again shows that you can build a house or build a building much more efficient and doesn't have to cost more. And of course, don't underestimate the value of these small improvements that you can do in your own home or in your business, etc. And basically what he was saying here is, you know, usual attitudes are that, you know, we do small changes at a time and then you get the diminishing return. Obviously, the jobs that are more expensive, we leave to the end, they're more expensive. But once you actually get to a point, you actually do all these tasks. Well, if you do a design a building and you actually do it correctly from the beginning, you'd be surprised that something you don't actually need, you know, an air conditioning unit if you do it properly. So you save all that capital cost. So suddenly you go from up top and you suddenly jump down. You actually have the same price or below. And this is seen time and time and again. And for many, many places, it's not just, oh, well, that's maybe just in that location, or I live in the tropics, it's too hard here, I need an air conditioner. With electricity, it's interesting. When my background, actually, my PhD was funded by the coal industry. I've worked in the business. And look, they know about carbon emissions. It's not something they don't know about. And even here, the CEO, Brad Page of the Energy Supply Association, representing basically the 40 major electricity and gas companies. They know it has to happen and they accept it. And equally, it's funny, we keep saying, oh, renewables, it's going to cost the earth. Well, what did he say? It's quite simple. If we were to go for the 20% renewable target by 2020, well, production is going to cost around 10%, and at the retail end, you're looking 4 to 6%. So what's 4 to 6% in 12 years' time for 20%? That's really, I don't know, that's not really much, to be honest. I don't know why anyone gets so caught up in about this sort of issue. The other issue where, of course, we're sort of not really going anywhere is passenger vehicles. Obviously, we hear a lot that maybe we are improving efficiency. Yeah, the engines are getting better, but people are buying more power-hungry vehicles, so we're really going nowhere. In 40 years, literally, we have gone nowhere. That's from the ABS survey. So we started 1963, 11.4, and we're still basically at 11.4. And if you think number of cars, well, too many on the road right now, well, you know, what did we start in? Sorry, the quality of that picture, but it started in 1998, and roughly 7.5 million cars, and it's projected to be around 15 million cars. So, you know, we're going a one-way road, and we're going the wrong direction. So, we really need to turn around and change our attitudes. And with the CPRS, you know, price does matter. People will change. We've seen it with the fuel costs. And so what really happens with the CPRS to get allow people to accommodate the change that the government has agreed and has agreed that it will do a 10% reduction in the fuel tax excise, and then it will be subject to review. For heavy vehicle users, they only have 1 year to accommodate the change before the government reviews this. So what are we actually looking at? Well, I've taken $25 there. You're looking petrol, roughly, it will cost you an extra 6 cents. Diesel, 6.8 cents, okay? So I know there's a bit sort of older numbers relative to 2007, but, you know, 6 on divided by 136, you're talking 4%, and that's probably less now. And it's a start. Obviously, it may well the price go up, and it's a price push thing. You know, you've got to cause the change, you know, and we adapt to, you know, increasing prices. I just want to touch there. I mean, just recently in September this year, the Brussels, the EU, were trying to push through the legislation to get the emissions down. And usual response from the car companies, no, it's too hard. You know, trying to do everything to stop it happening. You know, the usual, you know, the economics now are very fragile. You know, they're going to see accelerated losses in jobs, etc. But, you know, and it's interesting that the paradox is at the bottom, really, at the same time they're doing this, that the usual business as usual remedy was that the US government just decided to support $25 billion for the Detroit car manufacturers. And so I find it interesting, you know, here's the profits, or not lack of, for two of the companies. And why? Well, they're building the wrong thing, aren't they? They're being caught out in the market. Toyota, Honda, all that are getting market share. And I find it interesting that in Australia just recently that Holden GM are promoting now their 99-cent subsidies. So it's funny that they're willing to subsidise, you know, 50 cents a litre for fuel, but complain about the extra and what's going to impact on the industry, yet they can justify, you know, subsidising 50 cents on the cars for the next 2 years. Interesting. And then we have the other crying game, you know, Shell. The EU's looking, of course, you know, with their ETS about incorporating refineries and, you know, again, we're going to have to move to Arabia or something else because it's going to cost the world. And it's again, interesting, I mean, looking at their earnings, $32 billion, $26 billion, $26 billion, hardly crying poor. When I said for the whole of Australia, it's $11 billion. I mean, it's loose change, really, for someone like Shell. And, you know, really, what all for business is about regulation. They want to avoid this because of regulation. And we've seen now with the laissez-faire, you know, Reagan economics from the 1980s to now with the blow-up of the current, you know, markets, basically because of deregulation. And we see how companies will react when they don't have any regulation. They just go out of control. And it's nothing new in history. And of course, now with this current turmoil going on, we're hearing, you know, the new excuse, and you'll hear this more and more, we can't, for the new excuse to do nothing. You know, cost too high, it's delay, we must wait. And I sort of just thought I'd touch, just out of interest, between a very excellent book and just with the current turmoil of price histories. And I thought this was important because, well, obviously, humanity and modern economics, we don't have the same, you know, millions of years of data like Barry can regurgitate in a sense for climate change. And what we've basically seen in history is these periods of economic expansion and then a sudden collapse from whatever inputs there were. We've seen in the medieval price, it was the Black Death. 16th century, we had the Ice Age, which started, then it was, again, economic collapse. And this is repeated cycles. And we're currently in the fourth great wave now. And after each one, usually you see an equilibrium period. And it's quite interesting that, well, I don't know, we're pretty much at the end of, I'd say, at the current one. And I highly recommend you read that book if you really want to understand. And the prime drivers are always the same thing. There's population and then expansion of monetary supply. And the same results always end. You put price pressure on fuel, food, and then other commodities, and the consequences are what they are. And I think it's really important to know that, you know, basically we are going to come to a new period of equilibrium after this. And despite what's happening now, we think the world's going to end right now, and you're sure the depression's come and gone. But it's important to know that it's part of the evolution of, you know, what we do. It keeps happening. And just to prove, you know, these sort of things that people think, oh, yeah, it's all magic or something. Again, this is just illustrating about how prices do move with population. We got from the medieval, the 18th century, and more recently with the 20th century, obviously we've got the greatest population increase ever. So it's going to be interesting to see where it all ends. And again, we see interesting things with volatility. So the stability of the rate of change, and but we get increasing magnitudes of change and amplitude. So we get what we're seeing now, huge volatility. You see oil's gone from, you know, something from $80 to $149 back to $89. It's all been here before, and it will change. Feels bad now, but it's part of the process. And really, I'm going to leave with Alfred Tennyson, one of the greats, and that's really my conversation. Thank you very much.